Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 93-year-old Turk Eliadis of Bakersfield, California. We were talking about his college football career at the University of Nevada, where he played with the legendary fullback Marion Motley. At some point, I mentioned Paul Brown's team at Great Lakes Naval Air Station during the war, and I forgot that Marion Motley actually ended up playing for that team after Nevada. In fact, Motley was supposed to be discharged right before those Blue Jackets played Notre Dame in 1945, but he decided to stay in uniform long enough to help pound the Irish 39-7. He reunited with Coach Brown with the Cleveland Browns as one of the first African-American players in pro football, and in 1968, Motley was inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Turk Eliadis is part of a couple Halls of Fame, but on November 20th, 1944, he wasn't sure he was ever going to see his 22nd birthday. That's the day his P-51 Mustang was shot down over Holland.
The day that we flew, our leader was not a regular colonel that flew with us every day. It was a person, he worked in the office and so on, but he had to fly a certain number of hours to get his flight paid. And he was the one that was leading that day. We were told, when that young man in my barracks went down, that if we went down in the English Channel, we probably couldn't live more than 5 or 10 or 15 minutes because the water was so cold. They told us the temperatures were in places in the high 30s, low 40s. So what happened to him, I'm sure he died of exposure because we thought everything was okay. He waved at us and we got back, found out that he was passed away. I don't know. You think about all those times and so on. I remember the first mission I was into Germany. I was only 21 years old. And I remember once we got into German territory, I remember saying to myself, there's no friends down there.
And what were your typical missions like? Are you guys flying low and strafing?
There's a place called the Zuider Zee. Mm-hmm. And we would meet the bombers basically at that point. How do you know which group you're, let's say, covering and not mix it up with some other? If you look on a B-17 and you look at the tail will tell you the group. It might be a square, it might be a diamond, it might be a letter, it might be something. The letters for a 55th fighter group was Y something. If you saw a 51 that had the number Y something, it was from the 55th fighter group. Every group had a letter designation.
So most of your missions were escort missions for the bombers.
Oh, yeah, Practically everything. But we did a lot of strafing. Once we got the bombers back to friendly territory, depending on our leader, we went back and start strafing fields. We did a lot of strafing. You strafe an airfield, but the way we strafed it, we'd make a pass and then get the hell out of there. You know what I mean?
Couple things I want to rewind on and ask you about. You mentioned earlier of your father dying in the mining accident. You're already in the service at this point?
No.
You're at college still?
I was still in college.
And how devastating was that?
Oh, you just couldn't believe it. I was the oldest in the family. When I got there, to lose your dad and all the time that I spent with him, he used to prospect an awful lot. My dad actually worked a gold mine, a regular gold mine. I remember I was maybe sixth or seventh grade. I used to go, and there were two or three, I think there were three other Greek people that worked with my dad. I used to go with him when we used to prospect. I remember going all through all those mountains and so on, prospecting to see if there was a good place where they might find gold. My dad was in charge of all the dynamiting. Every night after work, they dulled the bars in the back of this home that we lived out of town. He had to sharpen them every day, and he did it always by hand, everything by hand, made the hole by hand. That's really why my dad got killed, when he was working at what we call the lime quarry. What they did, got a lot of raw material by dynamiting and getting all that and transporting it. The ore was mined in Ruth. It was brought to the mill in McGill. There it was refined. It was sent to another place where it was actually melted. And what they would do with this material that my dad, they would take and truck it up and dump it along the sides. But the day that he was in charge of all the charges, one didn't go off. Well, he waited, and then when he went to check, the damn thing went off. That's how my dad got killed.
When you find out that your father has died in this accident, and you know you've got a mother at home with six other kids to raise, and then you find out, hey, I'm heading overseas, was that hard? And did you wonder if you'd be coming back?
You know, that's something I don't know. I never thought about it. I knew I was going to go. You know, when I stop and think about that, probably I could have gone to the board and say, listen, I'm the oldest one in that family. I should be here to help my mother. That was something that never occurred to me. I was going to go, and that's the way it was.
And in combat, you flew P-51s.
Right.
What many would say is the greatest fighter plane that America had in World War II. If there's some P-47 pilots listening, I'm sure they're going to have a beef with you and have that argument with you. But you never flew it.
You don't have to tell me that, because one of the guys in prison with me was a P-47.
Oh, I'm sure you guys had plenty of time to talk about it.
He was with the 9th Air Force. They were ground support.
Uh-huh.
The P-47 had an air-cooled engine.
Right.
And the P-51 couldn't take the kind of hits that a P-47. The guy that I was in prison camp with, he told me there was many times he got banged pretty good, but he was always able to get back. And I can understand why they felt about that plane. But when it came to air combat, P-47, A-51, forget about it. They couldn't do it with a P-51.
They couldn't go as fast as you could. They didn't have the maneuverability that you had.
There were too many things that were bad.
But you never flew a P-51 until you were there in England.
That's
the very
right.
First time you flew it, it was a combat mission?
When we got to England, we went to a place called Gox Hill, and that was in the middle of England. And that's where all the Air Force personnel went. If a bomber needed replacements, that's where they got them from. If a fighter group needed replacements, that's where they got them from. I didn't know where I was going to go. There were four of us one day, and we ended up going with the 55th Fighter Group. And that's how we got to that group and so on. Okay, I'm getting ready to check out in a 51. So I went there, and the guy says, familiar yourself with all the instruments and so on. He put a blindfold on me, and he says, where's so-and-so? I'd point. Where's so-and-so? I'd point. He says, okay, take it up. I took it out there. The moment that I hit that accelerator and what it did at the airplane that I could never feel with a P-40, man, whoom. You could just feel it was just different, speed-wise and all those things.
Was it like the difference between your speed and Marion Motley's speed?
I don't know. I don't want to tell you. That guy was unbelievable. I think about it because I know the number of times I got knocked on my tail trying to block a defensive end. But if he could get around that end, man, he was awful hard to stop.
So you started to tell me about the mission that proved to be your last,
yeah.
Where instead of landing in France and being able to get back this time you're shot down over hostile territory. What happened? How did you get hit and how'd you go down?
We were supposed to strafe on the river.
The Rhine?
That goes basically north and a little bit to the west, and then it turns directly west and dumps into the English Channel. On this day, we were supposed to strafe on the Rhine, but it was really heavy cover. I mean, you couldn't see the ground. What would happen, we'd fly around, we'd find a hole, we'd dive down through the hole, and we did this eventually enough times, and we got down below the level. It must have been around 1,000, 1,200 feet. I don't remember. But we were around 600 feet or thereabouts. The guy that was leading us says, okay, get in flight formation. We're going home. I can remember distinctly to this day that when he said we were in friendly territory, let's go home, I thought, I remember Holland and a few of those places which were very close to where he was talking about. And I remember this Tudor 5-2, you sure we're in friendly territory? Yes. It wasn't maybe 2 or 3 minutes later, I get this jug. And I thought, what the hell's wrong? And pretty soon, I could see the tracers coming. We ended up going right over a flak battery. There were two other guys that went down. I didn't know what happened to them. They thought I got killed. They didn't know. Because once that happened, the planes just start scattering. right away when I got hit, and it started trying to go and try to. So I said, I got to get out of this plane. I can't. There's no way I can survive if I have to go into these dikes. There's no level ground around here. I got up to as much as I could to 1,000 feet, and I bailed out. And when I hit the ground, the parachute couldn't have been open very long, because the moment I hit the ground, those knees came clear up beyond my face. And I think I was out of it for a while. It was windy. Parachute was being drugged me, and I ended up in a ditch with water. And the moment I hit the water, I came to. But when I came to, I looked up on a bank, and here's a Sherman soldier pointing his gun at me, wanted me to get my hands up in the air. And that was it.
So because you had to bail out so low, the force with which you hit the ground sent your knees into your head and knocked you out.
It really, I don't remember being drug at all. The only thing I remember is the moment I hit that water, I came to. So I probably might have been out a little bit. I don't know.
And you were probably not too far from getting killed.
Well, there's a possibility.
I mean, you're probably a few seconds here or there, or
yeah.
The timing of it.
I don't know. It could have been very easily, because I didn't hit like I thought of. You know, we practiced with parachutes before we ever met on mission. I remember before I went to the group, we practiced. I mean, we had a place where we jumped off and opened the parachute and come down and get a feeling about what it was like and so on. But, you know, you never think that you're ever going to have to use a parachute. So,
and you probably never thought about being a prisoner before.
No, that never happened at all. I never thought that would happen.
So how did you deal with it when it was the reality staring you in the face?
I am going to tell you something. Gus Leslie was on a mission prior to when I went down. I remember when we get back, we talk about our mission, ask questions, and so on. But Gus wasn't in the same group that I was with. He was with a different one. The 343rd would go out, but you'd have four or five different flights in that particular one. I asked, where's Gus Leslie? Hey, where's Gus Leslie? No one knew. When I got shot down, the German soldier got me up in the air. They took me out into the middle of the, it was just an open area, I remember. It was a little bit of rain. The head guy comes out. There's a couple of them standing there, and he's talking. I know that if I was in Japan, I wouldn't be here. That guy could have taken out a gun, bang. No one knew what happened to me. When I finally, eventually, when I tell you, when I got back to the group, talking to the guys and so on, they didn't know. They thought I had got killed and so on. Well, anyway, they put two soldiers with me, and eventually they're going to take me to an interrogation camp. And in interrogation, you're told, you don't have to give him anything but name, rank, and serial number. Then he starts asking you about other things. Where'd you go to school? All this stuff and so on. The guy that interrogated me, he knew so much more about the 8th Air Force than I'll ever know. But before I went to see the interrogator, the guy takes me out of this room. You're in a single room, and I'm walking. And as I'm walking, a door open on my right opens up. You know who it was? Gus Leslie.
What are the odds?
There are no odds. I don't know how you could. As I was walking right there, the door opened, and I said, Gus. And then I thought, God, that's terrible. You better not say anything. But he got away. I mean, he went down. He got shot down, and he was free for several days. And then looking for food and stuff, they finally got him. And then eventually they put him in the interrogation area. But when I stop and think, that day when I was walking, he was had a hold of me, taking me to the interrogator. Gus Leslie comes up. Then it wasn't very long after that they got rid of us and sent us to Stalag 1. We went by train.
Well, and you know, when you say you yell out his name and then you wish you hadn't, because they can use you against him and vice versa and try to get two to talk about each other.
Yeah.
But I imagine just seeing his face had to be at the time really significant for some hope to know that, hey, there's somebody I know that's going through this with me.
Yeah, they picked him up. I can say one thing. I had two German soldiers with me all the time. I went by train a number of times. This one particular time, they had an air raid. I had to get off the train and go into a nearby bunker. When I was down there, The whole place was loaded with German soldiers with head wounds. Everything up here and so on. There was a woman come over, and she's talking from about there to you, looking at her. And I don't want to even look at her. I'm trying to look away from her. And she must have called me every name under the sun, talking in German. You know, when I think about that, they could have killed me right there. Nobody would have known anything like that. Just like when I bailed out and the head guy came out and they were talking, what they were talking about, to have a couple of guys and go with me and take me to an interrogation place. But I didn't know that at the time.
And they needed those guys to protect you because the civilians might do something else with you.
They were with me all the time. That's what helped me the time that I'm telling you about. When we got down there, and then, of course, the fact that I was a flyer and, you know, you're the enemy and that type of thing. And I was really glad because they stood one on each side of me when this gal was talking. And it didn't take long when it was over with. Boy, they got me out of there and so on. So from that standpoint, I was lucky that they were with me.
But 5.5 months of uncertainty were waiting for you as a prisoner of war. And we're going to hear about that with 93-year-old Turk Eliadis when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.